thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here in this late afternoon. I certainly thank the organizers. It's an honor to be able to speak with you today. You'll be happy to know that I'm here to give your brains a rest. I will not be talking about the seventh technological revolution or a plan to reformat the global architecture and replace it with an AI algorithm. What I would like to do is, as you are aware, of course, we are meeting today something in the shadow of some difficulties multilaterally and globally with respect to tensions arising from claims of inadequate IP protection and having to do with issues surrounding technology transfer and so forth. And what I'd like to do briefly is talk a little bit about, I was given a broad mandate, IP, trade, and development. Of course, there's 10,000 different things I could talk about under that mandate. But some background into the characteristics of intellectual property, how that relates to trade and development, and then it will eventually unfold, I hope, a bit how this gets into the current conflicts that are present between the USA and China and other regions like the EU and so forth. I'm not promising any solutions to this. So if I press the button for the literature. Press the button backwards. Okay. So, to establish a bit of common ground, intellectual property is an instrument of industrial policy. It's a way that governments seek to use these intangible benefits to improve economic growth and development and social welfare benefits. It's not a thing or a value in itself, either good or bad. It is basically a government tool. And everybody in the room is very familiar with the fact that intellectual property was devised to address the intangible characteristics of knowledge and information. Kenneth Arrow famously referred to as an incomplete appropriability of knowledge. That is, that knowledge is very difficult to contain, so we create legal structures to contain it. And we heard from WIPO this morning, and we're all very familiar with the fact that in order to accommodate a variety of different subject matter interests, IP takes different forms. All of these forms are really quite different, have different characteristics, which we won't go into right at the moment, but we have a lot of different types of instruments to deal with. And these precise characteristics of IP are defined by governments principally at the national level. As you know, we do have, and Tony Fallon described it, we've had other talks, the TRIPS agreement, and we'll talk a little bit about bilateral and regional arrangements, establish benchmark rules across the international system. But the scope, duration, and effect of each of these forms is subject to minute calibration. So these are government policy instruments that are calibrated, and despite all of the, shall we say, intellectual achievements of the economist, the correlation between the variables involved in intellectual property and their effect and outcomes are still very poorly understood. Simple illustration, we don't know a great deal about what the difference is between taking a 10-year patent term and a 30-year patent term and what impact that might have on the rate of innovation in a particular country. And a matter of some interest, the dispute over the past few years, for example, has been India's adoption of a standard of inventive step, which involves, you know, whether creating a new pharmaceutical involves a significant enhancement of efficacy, and whether that type of standard is appropriate to defining levels of inventiveness. And we have lots of different opinions about how these calibrations may work. And finally, and again, this is common ground to perhaps everyone in the room, Patents, for example, are by no means the only way to encourage innovation. Various types of subsidies and prizes are also available. And we have pioneering work by William Nordhaus, who was just awarded the Nobel Prize for this type of analytics. The conclusion of his pioneering work on the patent system was, if you want to tackle a very specific objective, you may be better off with a subsidy. So if you think I need a new jet fighter with a particular type of radar-eluding characteristics, you don't say, well, I've got patents and I hope someone will invent a new jet fighter. You say, I'm going to subsidize a particular company to develop this type of innovation because I'm targeting a particular outcome. On the other hand, patents are used when you want to say to the economy as a whole, I hope you will all go out and innovate and you'll contest with each other with these exclusive rights, and at the end of the day, hopefully we'll have a good amount of innovation. So it really depends what you're trying to accomplish. And so, for example, in China and in the United States, we have a lot of subsidization of research and development. The U.S. military development is heavily subsidized. Chinese military development is heavily subsidized. It isn't simply relying on a legal instrument to create innovation. Again, common ground. IP has important social welfare effects. We'll talk about this in some detail tomorrow in respect of public health. Some of those are positive, some of them are neutral, and some of them are negative. So the exclusionary effects of intellectual property may stimulate inventors to invent, but they also may deny access to technologies to people unable to afford a monopoly price. So they have positives and negatives, or neutral, and all of that has to be calibrated. So we have these very complex intellectual property rules, including at the multilateral level, that both prescribe forms of protection and rights of exclusion, but at the same time provide exceptions and ways to balance those rights of exclusion in terms of adjusting to social welfare interests. Finally, and very importantly, something I do a lot of work on is the role of competition law. And the Chinese government is very interested in the application of competition law to intellectual property rights. And through a continuous monitoring of market impacts, you can attempt to balance or offset what might be negative impacts of exclusionary rules. So all of these go to creating the intellectual property environment, hopefully in a socially productive way. Intellectual property rules are primarily instruments of national policy. And this is, again, something that is well recognized. Different countries, there's no one-size-fits-all prescription for intellectual property rules. And so even the TRIPS agreement builds in, famously, various flexibilities. But these national rules may have significant trade and investment effects. And the trade and investment effects of intellectual property are actually highly complex. And again, they may be quite dependent on the characteristics of the individual host and foreign nations. So when China, for example, underprotects intellectual property, that might have a significant impact on foreign direct investors of the United States, and it may have trade effects, and reciprocally, the USA's actions impact China. But if Ecuador underprotects intellectual property, it's unlikely to have a material impact on the economy of Peru. And you similarly have different questions with countries, for example, like China and India, and their reciprocal interaction. So getting to some of the roots of today's problems, of course, if we go back, we know that capital exporting countries tend to favor strong IP protection in importing countries because they're seeking to protect the value of their innovation and research and development, which is generally secured through some form of royalty payments, either implicit or explicit. Of course, you can take the view that strong IP protection isn't always beneficial for capital exporting countries, because, and I think China is a good case, if China, through, let us imagine, under protection, enjoys a period of rapid economic growth and sustained development and provides a bigger market for U.S. foreign investors or exporting countries, that's also providing a benefit to those companies. So weak protection may be beneficial as well as strong protection, but typically the foreign capital exporters tend to prefer strong protection. And similarly, we know capital importing countries tend to favor weak IP protection to lower the cost of acquiring new goods, services, and technologies. And for these countries, strong IP protection, if we take, I don't mean to pick on Ecuador, we can pick on Botswana or any lesser developed country, putting in strong IP protection is not likely to encourage major investments in innovation. So for a country with a relatively weak and small economy, under protection may in fact be the best path. Now, sorry, one second, I went the wrong way. So getting to how these trade and economic development issues began to arise. Of course, everyone's familiar. We had the GATT-Uruguay round from 1986 to 1993, which involved the then capital IP exporting countries, the USA, Europe, and Japan, were seeking to protect their investments in innovation. And this was substantially accomplished through the WTO TRIPS agreement. And a very important component of that agreement was the single undertaking, the idea that every country had to agree to this basically approximated set of intellectual property rules, a form of strong IP protection. Of course, there were transition periods built in. And though perhaps not, you could argue, today, the wisdom of this whole single undertaking idea is what is really under challenge with respect to the WTO. This is at the root of today's issues with respect to the WTO. That is that each member has to accept all of the obligations in the first place, number one, and number two, that to create new obligations, every country must agree. So you have a consensus rule, right? And these two things have really made it extraordinarily difficult to achieve new agreements at the WTO, because you have a great deal of difficulty convincing countries who view particular things not being in their interest to go along with a new set of rules. So what you have today is a pushback against this idea of the single undertaking. Combined with, so the difficulties in achieving progress at the WTO, reflected in part by gaps in the TRIPS agreement, as well as, and we've heard about this today, the evolution of technology, talked about the different rules, have led to what we see as a proliferation of bilateral, regional, and plurilateral agreements, number one. So we're all familiar with these, the TPP becoming the comprehensive agreement on, you know, trade protection and so forth. But we've gone from a world in which multilateralism was really the fundamental approach to today. Most government trade offices are devoting most of their attention to bilaterally negotiating or regionally negotiating where they think they have the most ability to gain trade concessions. And a critical component of that as well is that much of the attention has shifted from trade, that is movement of goods across borders, to investment protection. And intellectual property is now considered a key component of this intellectual property protection included in investment chapters and investment dispute settlement. So, one thing that we're pretty certain of, and this is the economic analysis and projections of this date back at least do some pioneering work from Keith Maskus back in the early 2000s, showing an arc of development and where interests of countries will cross over between benefiting from weak IP protection to benefiting from strong IP protection, and capital importing countries, which is a characteristic of China, evolve into capital exporters. And as with China, you have increased domestic R&D investment, which naturally leads national industries to begin to demand stronger IP protection. So I think it's fair to say that China appears to have exceeded the crossover threshold to where it benefited more greatly from weak IP protection and appropriation of technology to strong IP protection and investment in indigenous R&D. It is in the midst of that transition, and China still is seeing trade-offs between weaker protection, that is reducing acquisition costs, and stronger protection, increased investment in resulting in increased investment in research and development. And again, there's nothing at all new about this, right? So the USA appropriated technology from Britain during the Industrial Revolution. Japan, Korea, and Taiwan appropriated technology from the United States in the 1980s and 1990s. And similarly, China. And you know, we're often confronted with revisionists who might suggest that somehow China's miraculous economic growth, and yes, this has been one of the great economic success stories in all of history, is China's transition from the late 1980s to today. So it's enjoyed a remarkable historic period of growth, but that was largely done under a realm of underprotection, in which the United States was constantly badgering China about its lack of IP protection, and yet during that period, China was enjoying sustained and rapid economic growth. Now today, as I mentioned, China's vision and internal needs have changed. Today, China is interested in the technologies of the future and investment in R&D. And indeed, the data shows that China is doing remarkably well, I think, in implementing its IP system. I myself would go so far as to suggest that there is greater risk to China, and in fact, greater risk to the United States from China's overprotection of intellectual property rather than underprotection. China is granting a tremendous number of patents. Chinese companies are beginning to enforce them in the United States. Chinese companies are enforcing them in China. I don't know who in the United States is creating the literature that suggests that China isn't enforcing IP, but my personal view from reading the data is that China is doing a great deal to enforce IP, and so my own personal view is that this isn't a problem of Chinese underprotection of IP anymore. If anything, we're getting to a realm of overprotection. But perhaps more central to the current area of disputes is the transfer of technology disputes. And you know, this is a very complex problem set. Many of you in the room aren't old enough to remember it. But these transfer of technology issues formed a very important part of the China accession negotiations back in the mid to late 1990s. In fact, resulted in some commitments from China with respect to transfer of technology and policies in that area. The rules of the WTO are both complex and uncertain and may not cover a number of the things that are currently being complained about. We could talk more about the specifics of what the current dispute are, but a lot of the dispute and a lot of the, if you think there may be needs for new rules, have to do with a lot of the U.S. current complaints deal with investment protections as opposed to trade issues. And the WTO really isn't a investment organization, it's a trade organization. So if you look at the new bilateral and regional arrangements, you'll see that they typically include provisions addressing requirements of technology transfer as part of the investment chapters of those agreements. So there certainly are ways to address these problems. Finally, and I'm being brief, and as I say, I wanted to give your brains a rest. One of the things that's currently happening, really, as part of this whole single undertaking concept of the WTO, we had this idea of special and differential treatment for developing countries. And at that stage, China was considered a developing country. We now have an interesting argument about where China may stand in this hierarchy of developing countries. But we see, just as a phenomenon emanating, we went through a period of a couple of decades where this idea of favoritism towards developing countries, and particularly low and middle income countries, was widely acknowledged within the global community, that low and middle income countries should be provided with particular flexibilities. The current thinking, at least emanating from Washington, is to basically abandon this idea of special and differential treatment, that we're trying to maximize through mercantile policies the amount of royalties we can extract from pretty much every country we deal with, whether they're high-income countries or low-income countries. So this has really become a change or a differential in international economies. As I say, requiring these sorts of demands on smaller low-income countries isn't really necessarily going to produce a positive result, and yet low and middle income countries really lack the bargaining power to determine the terms of trade. You saw how difficult it was for Canada and Mexico to address trade issues with the United States. Imagine you are Peru or Botswana or even South Africa trying to bargain favorable terms of trade in that type of environment. So we have a drawback on this idea of special and differential treatment. We'll talk tomorrow about public health, which is a particular area of my own concern, is that these demands for a reversion away from flexibilities for low and middle income countries is going to have harmful social welfare impact. So I hope that gave your brain something of a break from the intellectual discussion that preceded it, and I hope the follow-on conversation may perhaps revert to that high level of intellect. So I thank you very much.
I want to ask Albert, of the over protection, then the underground protection. What's the meaning? I want to ask what's the reason to tell us it is a good choice for China to select the strong protection or weak protection? Thank you.
Well, it's a very complex question to answer, but if you look at the data, the Chinese SIPO has been granting a very large number of patents, for example, both utility patents and design patents, and I understand through some very good research and writing by Chinese scholars, that the Chinese government is providing essentially incentives for the filing of patent applications and being rewarded with a patent, which creates, in a way, an artificial incentive both at the federal and provincial level for the filing of large numbers of patents. If those patents are granted and if attempts are made to enforce those patents, that could result in basically creating impediments to new technologies actually being researched and entering into the market. That's one small part of it. Another part of it, for example, has to do, and I'm going to talk tomorrow morning about public health. So there's been a lot of consideration within China lately about extending scopes of protections in the pharmaceutical arena, including creating patent linkages, including extending duration of marketing exclusivity and covering biologic medicines, and potentially reducing the scope of exceptions and so forth, all as part of an understandable concept of promoting R&D investment in the biotech sector. Now, of course, we're all very interested in biotech innovation, and as I understand it, and we'll talk tomorrow, you know, and it was mentioned a bit earlier, China, for example, has a large problem with incidence of cancer and you know, really need innovation in this area. But you run into an inevitable problem, particularly with President Xi's commitment to universal health care, of how you're ultimately going to balance the costs of the new medicines and the access and the budgetary considerations going to the federal government and state government level. So how you calibrate these periods of protection is very important to ultimately what your budget expenditures are going to be. So I've participated in discussions here and, you know, abroad about the parameters that are being looked at. And if you, I would say, finally, and it's too long of an answer, I suppose, but I'm familiar also with the litigation practice now in China with IP. And I've been coming to China since the early 90s, was, you know, involved in talking with government officials about the old GATT and, you know, how that worked and so forth, and have been returning periodically. And to my personal view, China has made tremendous strides in the development of its courts and the implementation of IP rules and infringement actions and so forth. So to begin with, I'm not convinced that China is actually under-protecting IP and that, you know, you don't have the, there aren't remedies available to companies to bring action. I think by now the system is pretty well established and working pretty well. And I wasn't saying that I'm deeply concerned about overprotection, but if you ask me on balance, would I be personally more concerned about underprotection, which I don't think is the case now, or overprotection, which I think is something of a push, I would be more inclined to be a bit more open, less restrictive than more restrictive, though I appreciate it's a very difficult question. But and that's probably too long of an answer. But you know, it's a very good question.
Mm-hmm. Oh.